towards the Nazi war. But what about abortion in America or in any Western country? It is the Supreme Court with one voice majority which decided that the unborn human being is not a human being. Legally, it's not a human being. They disregard the fact that you can, after 3 months, already define what the eyes of the, you hear the heartbeat, you know it's a boy or a girl, you can determine the color of the eyes, and they have the Spirit of God. But still, legally, they are non-legal persons.
Non-persons, yeah, very simple.
Non-persons,
right.
And they are being killed to the millions. I think we are now close to the whole, alone in America, not to speak of Western Europe, in the 40 millions. And I would think that is the most grisly aspect of modern life, where Hitler would be delighted if he would still be alive, or how his concepts of different values in human beings would be executed today. And I'm very much looking forward to the nominees of President Bush to be nominated, really, to be voted and installed and get that changed. Because if that doesn't change, we will never be victorious over terrorism if we don't liquidate the terrorism against the unborn human life in our own society.
Yeah, basically what you're saying is that the Holocaust, say, for example, was a legal event because the Reichstag simply said the Jews were non-persons.
Yeah.
And here we have started playing that game, both with euthanasia and with abortion, as to what is human and what is non-human. And it tends to slide over time, if you notice that. That definition changes based on the political winds.
Yes, and it's also noticeable that the murdering of the Jews in Poland or wherever it physically took place, or in Germany, was done by night. In other words, the trains went by night and not by day. So very, very few people who were not involved had any idea what was going to happen. Now, the Holocaust, the abortion, it is public. You have a section of Congress who, and right now, desperately fighting to maintain it. There are millions of people who support it. They are, of course, brainwashed because they think it's the right of the woman, which a woman has no right about her body than has a man. It's God's property. So there is a substantial difference in how far we have gone down as humanity. Now, the other one, just to be honest, we had the Gestapo in front of our church. Gestapo is a secret state policy, and the Gestapo was responsible for taking people out of wherever they were who were opposed to the Nazis, and we had them, I see them in front of me, two men in front of our church, when my parents and we four children went to church, and they stood there, and then they noted down the people who went into church, pure intimidation. The idea was they had a separation of church and state, as we, I'm an American citizen by now, so as we have here in America, and they told the Hitler Youth, and in school they told us that religion is for old people, for old women. We are tough for it, and you can sing psalms and pray in your home or in church, but in the society, that's the way we, the Nazis, determine what is happening. So what they wanted was not a separation of church and state. They were out for a separation of God and society, and that is precisely the same here today. They are trying to chase God out of schools and public buildings or public events and everything. And that cannot stand. That must not stand. And that America, if America doesn't deal with this question fundamentally and wipes them out, I don't think we are going to survive in freedom.
How do you figure that Germany went the way that it did? Did you ever come up with a list in your mind of why it was the Christians never did anything in Germany?
Well, for Christians it's called sin. I have made a division of where we are in the world. Looking at myself, I've made a list of all my lies, all my cheating, all my stealing. I lied to my parents, I lied to my teachers, I lied to my friends. My lies were always for a small purpose of myself. The Nazis lied for political ends. But there was no substantial difference in a lie. A lie is a lie. And whether a lie is a big lie or a small lie, who is going to decide this? We never know what effect a lie has, because every lie hurts somebody. It doesn't only hurt God, hurts somebody. And they say huge doors hinge in small hinges or move in small hinges. So I had my list, and that is when it dawned on me, when I saw my own life, and I said to myself, if everybody is like myself, if all Germans are like myself, no wonder that the Nazis could do what they did. And that was exactly the case.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz show. I want to thank local reporter and very good person, Susan McLaughlin, who is here sharing the first hour with me and getting the word out on Smart Growth in Watsonville and a little bit on the Sierras. We'll have to come back and do more of that here in the near future. But for the second hour, we're going to shift gears a bit, and our conversation is going to be with Attorney Greg Broderick, who is going to, our topic is going to be private property and why it matters. But before I bring Greg on, I think we're having a little audio difficulty here, and technical assistance is struggling its way through. I guess I got the high sign, so I think we're back in. But private property is, of course, George Washington said, private property and freedom are inseparable. And so that's clearly why we see the forces of sustainable development making as their centerpiece the attack that seeks the elimination of private property during the 21st century. And they're doing that piece by piece, citizen by citizen, property by property. And with accelerating success. So that's why it's timely to understand the nature of that attack and how the lawyers who understand these issues are attempting to defend not just their clients, but every one of us. Because without private property, you don't have private action, you don't have private lives. What you have is government and control. And that, of course, is the goal of those who are at the core of sustainable development. Most of the people who are implementing it are simply useful to that black light that has that panders them with grants and other forms of poison candy in order to bring down the American ideal. Well, let's see if we can bring Greg. We don't have Greg up quite yet, so we'll do that here shortly. Private property. If you've got questions or comments as the show proceeds, the local phone number is 464-8295 and the toll-free number is 888-245-4237. You see, private property and liberty are really corollaries. We talked in the first hour about the development of individual conscience, and if we're going to have a society that that is peaceful, genuinely peaceful, not peaceful simply because authoritarianism is so strong that you dare not step out of line, but peaceful because you've developed that conscience and you're in a position where you understand that your life is enhanced if you respect the equal rights of another. And of course that's the justice system that sustainable development seeks to replace, going from a system of a system of equal justice into a system of social or group rights justice. And once that happens, we no longer have the kind of economic system that supports freedom in America, and that is a free enterprise system. You see, the sustainable development documentations openly call for government-private partnerships. And so that's why you see out in the rural areas the Nature Conservancy partnering with its governmental agencies through regulatory zoning initiatives that knock down values of property, and then coordinating with the federal government for financing programs to come in and sweep this up and manage it pursuant to sustainable development objectives. And of course, they don't work. You know, for the rest of us, the nature of management has of land management has shifted, and people aren't allowed to do anything. Government agents keep trying, they keep failing, they keep using your money. They do what you're not allowed to do with your land, but that's the nature of how government-private partnerships work, and it's what we need to reverse and cause America to resume its position as the first nation of the land of the free. We'll be right back with our guest.
The agenda is set. Santa Cruz County government has determined that your bumper-to-bumper commute on Highway 1 is a good idea. Your car is an environmental hazard, and they have a plan to clean it up. I'll be right back.
Just to let all you listeners know, we're playing a replay from our show last year with Greg Brodzik from the Pacific Legal Foundation. Second hour, Michael Shaw will be back with Jim Burling talking about the Kelo case. And so be stay tuned.
The Santa Cruz County Government, the Board of Supervisors on the county level, and the mayors and their councils on the city level were all presented with and asked to endorse a policy planning guide called Santa Cruz County Local Agenda 21, a Sustainable Community Action Plan, our agenda for the 21st century. Unfortunately, for those of us who live here, this plan was endorsed. As a matter of fact, it was not only endorsed, it was adopted, embraced, and is now in a full implementation phase by county planning and government. If you are listening on your car radio, crawling in gridlock over highways 1 and 17, you are experiencing the very real-world application of Agenda 21. Those stop-and-go bottlenecks that you're dealing with every day are intentional. They are designed to socially engineer you away from your car and into alternative modes of transportation. The fact that Santa Cruz County government expects traffic congestion to become so intolerable that within a few short years, their more suitable, non-polluting modes of transportation will be used is now clear and understood by many. Their desired state is written in Santa Cruz County Local Agenda 21. It says,
public subsidies are to be shifted from funding highway construction, road maintenance, policing traffic, and publicly funded parking to developing and promoting transportation alternatives.
One of the many goals in the Agenda 21 chapter on transportation is
increase public awareness about personal and societal transportation choices, including walking, bicycling, rail, and bus use.
How effective are we at shopping and carrying home groceries while pedaling our bicycles, riding a new coastal train, or navigating from one county bus transfer to another? To the average American family of four, good luck. Enough of this nonsense. We need to widen Highway 1, and we need to begin construction now. If we allow the planners to do nothing, the people of Santa Cruz County will suffer, in that more and more time will be spent commuting to and from work, school, and everyday errands. That dividend pays off as less and less time spent with loved ones. In the pursuit of happiness, this is Florence Braden.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw, and we're here with our guest who's now on the line to talk about private property and why it matters. Our guest is Greg Brodzik, an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation based in Sacramento. And are you there, Greg?
Yes, I am.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. And it's going to be nice to deliver the message that this subject brings about. Tell us about a little bit about yourself, Pacific Legal Foundation, and what makes you focus on issues related to private property.
Well, Pacific Legal Foundation's motto is rescuing liberty from the grasp of government, and one way that we do that is by So the chief way that we do that is by litigating important cases to set nationwide precedent. And we have three main areas of focus, and two of those are private property rights and environmental law, and the environmental law sort of insofar as it relates to private property rights, given the major impact environmental laws can have on private property rights, it's a sort of natural confluence between the two. PLF started in 1973 with some lawyers who had worked for the Reagan administration when he was governor of California. Came out of there and founded PLF because what they found were there were all these highly motivated interest groups claiming that they were out there representing the public interest and trying to tear down things like reasonable welfare reform and so on and so forth. So PLF started to kind of give the regular folks a voice in the courts and to litigate in favor of traditional values and private property rights. Myself, I came to PLF about 18 months ago out of law school in Berkeley. And really, the year and a half that I've spent here, I have seen a lot of things that you might not otherwise pay attention to, or you might not otherwise believe, in terms of the kind of abuse that government can really visit on citizens and in particular property owners. I was always sort of a moderate guy before I got here, and I consider myself a reasonable person to this day. But you really, unless you are in this line of work, you really will be shocked by a lot of the things that you hear. So that's why I continue to work here, and that's why I enjoy my job, is I get to help fight back a little bit when government is stealing liberty from people, particularly from property owners.
Well, you know, if your property is stolen from you, it makes it very difficult to express your liberty in speech or in association, because if you make the wrong move, and the government has the power to steal your property, you're going to lose your property. So I always like to remind people that without private property, there's really no freedom to speak, there's no freedom to associate, there's no freedom to produce, because the result of your effort can just simply be confiscated. So you know, without private property, that's why Washington was right. You can't have freedom. And so a reasonable person, I think, would do exactly what you're doing, and that's why it's so refreshing to have young people and young lawyers coming out of school who recognize that there's something wrong with the way this pendulum has has lost its bearing and seems to be out of control. Let's talk a little bit about the nature of private property, what it is, and why you might think it's the cornerstone of a free society.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, private property is the cornerstone of a free society, and it could not be expressed in a better way than in those simple, five or six words. Without private property, you really have no ability to do anything. You have no ability to sustain yourself. And without private property, you must rely on someone or something else for your existence. The most basic form of private property, although you probably don't think of it this way, would be like the food that you eat and the bed that you sleep in. I mean, most people think, at least in here in Northern California, think of private property as houses and big tracts of land, office buildings, but break it down to its most essential form, and private property is, includes everything, including the food on your table and the clothes on your back. And
well, it includes one's hand. It includes one's thoughts.
Quite right. I mean, it includes your body even. And so that's the sort of the base justification why private property is the cornerstone of a free society. And there are really two elements that justify two good reasons, and one of them is a utilitarian reason, that is, society works better with private property, and the other is a sort of a moral reason. Private property is right. And on the utilitarian side, obviously without private property, like, what would you eat and what would you wear? At some point you have to reduce food to a state where it is not usable by anybody else. It's only usable by you. And you have to reduce your clothing to your body. And so that, you know, that, that, in that basic sense, it's important. And then, and also, you know, society, private property helps society in that, you know, it enhances wealth on a societal wide basis. And then, as we've seen, both with our own government and with other governments, and private property is without exception more efficiently used and certainly less wasteful in private hands than it is in state-held hands. And then lastly, private property, especially, you know, distributed private property, I mean by distributed, I mean available to anyone through his own hard work, fosters a political stability in that, you know, if you have private property, if you have things to possess, and if you know that if you're secure in your possession of your things, you're more likely to live in an orderly fashion. And of course, the moral justifications for private property, I mean, you can go back, you know, into Genesis or into the Quran or wherever you want to go, but, you know, every society basically recognizes some degree of private property rights. You know, there's a question of what that degree is, and we could talk about biblical truths or moral and religious philosophers from the Middle Ages up to the Enlightenment, John Locke, and up to, you know, modern times, people like a lot of the people I work with or with scholars like Stephen Eagle. But, you know, the moral justification for private property is really just basically that it comes down to it's the natural order of things that you have to be able to accumulate, you know, acquire and use your private property.
Well, it's the natural order of things unless the agent of force steps in between the pursuit of your life and yourself and puts a block on that path and does it backed up by force. And that really becomes the nature of the struggle that Americans, many Americans, are facing today.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think the key here is to recognize where private property comes from. And if you recognize that principle point, then it flows from there. You know, there are a lot of people, especially now, who think, you know, oh, well, private property comes from the government. The government sort of hands you the right to own your property, right? You get a deed, it has sealed the state of California on it or whatever. You know, that's not, you know, private property, go all the way back to the beginning before there was a government, you know, and whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist or whatever you are, you know, at some point there were people and there was stuff. And there was no overarching governmental regime. And, you know, the people decided, you know, hey, gee, I'd like to eat. You know, I'm going to grow some food or I'm going to pick some fruit, and reduced it to private property. And so really where private property comes from is it really comes from the work of an individual. The labor of your hands is where private property comes from. Now, I don't labor too much with my hands, although I do type quite a bit. But, you know, really the you know, anybody who goes to work and makes a paycheck or goes out and farms a field or raises crops or horses, I mean, that's where private property comes from, is the work of your hands. And you have the right, in general, to own and to possess and to use the things that you work for. So private property really comes from an individual and from his labor, and not from, it's not a gift from the government to be taken back at the government's desire. It's not an entrustment from the government to be removed when it's no longer convenient or utilitarian for you to own that property anymore. And so if you understand that that's where private property comes from, that you make it, that you create it, then you know it's sort of immoral or unfair for someone to take it from you without, you know, justification and without assent and without giving some value in kind.
Well, in the Soviet Union, property came from people. There was no incentive, number one, and there was no morality, number two, in that system. But, you know, it strikes me that the character of private property really does cause people to engage in productive effort. And that comes because if you've got the result, if the product of your labor is yours, then that enhances and encourages one to freely think and freely express and freely act. And when you do that, you become productive. And And then that leads to voluntary trade, and where you've got some milk and I've got a dollar, and we both think we'd be better off by trading, and so we do. That results in mutual benefit, and it leads to societal gains, because everybody who produced that milk also gained along the way. So it's peaceful, because everything is voluntary, and the interaction requires the consent of both parties when you have a system of private property, and that causes prosperity to arise, and competitive efforts lead to societal improvement, and harm doesn't happen because the equal rights of each citizen to control their action, to control their thoughts, and to use their property is recognized.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And that security in knowing that you're going to be able to enjoy the fruits of your labor both motivates you to labor so that you can enjoy it, and it keeps you from, it really keeps you from, you know, seeking to abuse others or take from others. If you know you can make something yourself and keep it, you're certainly much less likely to go and take it from somebody else.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it starts with the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, and it moves on to the Fifth Amendment, and I'm getting the message here, we're not taking a break.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, look at Exodus 20:15. You know, thou shalt not steal. You know, but it's replete, you know, throughout the Bible. Now you can if you want, you can dispute, you know, the basis for the Bible or the truth of the Bible or whatever. But that's not the point. The point is, you know, these laws, which everyone agrees was written down at least about around 1500 B.C. You know, I mean, that is a long, that is a 3,500 year tradition of respect for private property. You go back to the mid 18th century BC, Hammurabi lays down the Code of Hammurabi, generally understood as the sort of first comprehensive code, and it lays out very precise rules on real property. It lays out, you know, if it lays out rules for things as complicated as adverse possession, you know, the idea that if somebody abandons his private property for a certain period of time, you know, somebody else can take it over. I mean, that is a detailed system of private property that has arisen, you know, 3,700 years ago.
Well, and it works. But what's happened in America, and, you know, we could have another show about the source of this, is that most people think that what is theirs is theirs, and they recognize the importance of their own private property and certainly don't want it stolen. That's why they lock their doors if they're nervous about that, or lock their cars, because they want to protect their private property. But when it comes to their neighbor, they want to be able to control what their neighbor does with their property. So it's a system where too many of us are thinking that what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine, and that simply won't work long, because that fuels those who would like to take advantage of an opportunity to gain control over everybody, and that's what we've done with overly designed zoning regulations that allow, in effect, third-party arbiters, the government, to determine what it is that some people can or can't do with their lives. You know, and the discussion about theft brings me to think about the California Supreme Court Justice Janice Brown, who said not long ago in an opinion where she was the sole, she wasn't sole, she was part of a dissenting group with that court on an important property rights case. She said, quote, "Once again, the majority of this court has proved that if enough people get together and act in concert, they can take something and not pay for it. But theft is still theft. Theft is theft even when the government approves of the thievery. Turning a democracy into a kleptocracy does not enhance the stature of the thieves. It only diminishes the legitimacy of the government." And I think, if we just had more judges like Janice Brown, who could inspire the young people and maintain order with the adults with common sense and moral perspectives as what she takes, this country would be in good shape. And that's why I like to quote Janice Brown so that more people become aware that there are some good judges out there. And, you know, unfortunately, there aren't enough of them. And in fact, this is the same Janice Brown that the Senate turned down, did they not, for a high federal court appointment?
That's right. Justice Brown has been on the California Supreme Court for a while now. She was on the Court of Appeal before that. She was Governor Wilson. She helped Governor Wilson out in legal affairs. But, yeah, that's right. She was appointed by President Bush to the D.C. Circuit, basically what's considered the highest court of appeal in the land. And the Senate really raked her over the coals for her, in large part, for her defense of private property. And for her views that, you know, people are better when left alone by the government. I mean, she gave a speech, I think, at the Institute for Justice a couple of years ago, and they were quoting out of the speech, and she was saying, look, you know, government, when people are left, the American people are hardworking people, you know, with a cultural legacy, and they're united by a dream of freedom, and they're better off when left alone, and when government comes in, you know, it screws everything up, and it's immorality and societal decay. And, you know, what seems like common sense to most of us, she was absolutely raked over the coals for that in front of the Judiciary Committee, and they finally would not allow an up or down vote on her and held her up forever. And we doubt that we'll be seeing her on the federal bench anytime soon, which is a tragedy.
Well, it really is. I remember a particular senator in the halls labeling her a Neanderthal. You know, a woman is a descendant of a slave. And some people can get away with saying most anything, and it's doubly egregious in this situation because that Senator Ted Kennedy, one might say, is a bigot against ideas. And, you know, that's probably his greatest offense, and people like that, in my opinion, should be removed from the United States Senate.
Yeah, well, I wish the people of Massachusetts would do it, but I guess they're not going to help us out anytime soon. But you know, I mean, you look at the things that Janice Brown says have such a lengthy history, not only in, you know, theory and thought, but, you know, in the founders of our government. John Adams says as early as 1790 that property must be secured or liberty cannot exist. And it's John Adams. This isn't some radical, guy who wants to go drill in the Arctic National Wildlife and pull out the oil. And this is John Adams, you know, first Vice President of the United States. The property must be secured or liberty cannot exist. You know, property ownership is an essential prerequisite of liberty, that it's the guardian of every other right. I mean, these things go back hundreds, really thousands of years, but go back, you know, to the founding of the Constitution. And yet, you know, for whatever reason in this age, you know, anybody who espouses those thoughts is instantly, you know, thought to be some kind of dim-witted person. And you know, you want to talk about where those other, you want to talk about who's the Neanderthal. The Neanderthal is the person who thinks that a collective despotism is somehow more enlightened than the protection of individual liberties.
Well, that's certainly, the way most governors through history, the Neanderthal days, if you will, how it was conducted. And, that's the marvel of the American experiment. It really is mankind's greatest achievement. And, we're facing a straight-up challenge to that. On this show, Greg, we're providing information to people here in Santa Cruz and across the country about the nature of sustainable development, an organized program that espouses a different set of ideas about the answer to the question of where do rights come from. And, sustainable development is something that originates on the political globalist scene, and those folks don't look to the Declaration of Independence for an understanding of the nature of rights. They look to the Declaration of Human Rights. I always like to say about human rights, you know, human rights, animal rights, what's the difference? You know, they're granted by men who have more power over others, and while they can be granted, they can also be denied.
Right.
You know, that's the difference between the United States and the United Nations. And the massive assault that we're seeing on private property, particularly in the rural areas across America, is something that reflects this different set of ideas, as does Senator Kennedy's comment about Justice Brown. when they seek a system where community rights override the unalienable rights that rest within each of us. And that's really what the issue is all about, I think, is whether or not we're going to live in a society that recognizes what is. And the what is that each human being is imbued or is inherent with a set of rights to his life, his liberty, and his property. And that's what the battle in America is right now. It's a silent battle simply because the forces of a new system of rights seem to have control of the media by and large. And this straightforward discussion that carries forth the great tradition of America as espoused by John Adams with that great quote you just gave, Greg, is really what things are all about right now. And I'm happy to see what I think is a resurgence in attention. You know, as people become more and more trampled by government, that spirit rises up, and that's what's inherent here in America. And I think that's what we're going to see more of as we rid ourselves of this sustainable development beast.
Shaw, I've been asked, what is abundance ecology? Well, it begins with the idea that an owner's right to determine the use of his property is the very essence of private property. This is well illustrated by George Washington's eloquent statement, "Private property and freedom are inseparable." Abundance ecology rejects the wrongly premised hysteria over endangered species, invasive species, and other political tools that promote state collectivism. Instead, abundance ecology is guided by the simple exercise of reason for the supreme importance of human life, individual liberty, and private property, and the awareness of the great potential associated with innovation that arises in a society where individual liberty is the central organizing principle. As California, the nation, and the world are being redirected by a new central organizing principle that calls for the preservation of nature, both man and nature have begun to experience the appearances of shortages. For example, the National and State Endangered Species Acts, modeled on United Nations treaties, have brought degradation to the wildlands within the United States, while citizens and society at large are stripped of wealth and immense potential benefits. The effect of the Endangered Species Act and its soon-to-be-birthed offspring, the Invasive Species Act, is to eliminate from an owner in America his right to determine the use of his property. While regulatory efforts have failed to serve society or nature, the restoration of freedom will fuel our happiness and resume the American tradition of advancing improvement one step at a time. A wealthy nation takes interest in its ecology. Free people take the action necessary to advance their own interests by creating benefits that extend to others. This includes an improving natural world. The practice of abundance ecology works to release the potential productivity and diversity of a landscape. To achieve this end, an owner must be free to engage in rigorous disturbance and free to pursue a reasoned and creative process of trial and error. This process is suited to the choice of each individual and the uniqueness of each property. The foundation of abundance ecology theory is the knowledge that a direct relationship between man and his land is paramount. An improving planet is possible only in a society that respects the ideals of private property, individual liberty, and human life. Welcome back to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. I'm Michael Shaw, the host this evening, and I'm here with my guest, Greg Broderick of the Pacific Legal Foundation, and we're discussing private property and why it matters. And Greg, our first half hour is one where I think a lot of information on the abstract level was packed in, and as people begin to
resurrect their understanding of how it is that a free society operates. I think reflecting on the kinds of ideas that you've been espousing here is going to be very helpful. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in the area of the courts and what kind of issues might be relevant to this discussion.
Well, I mean, you see so much of this impacting, you know, I see so much of it impacting us through the courts. You know, in the first instance, you know, it's a problem because people like Janice Brown that we just talked about are kept off of the court. Anyone who believes in any kind of private property rights is kept off the court. You know, the other way that you see it, unfortunately, I think as a result of people like Justice Brown being kept out of the federal courts, is that those federal courts are turned into an enforcement mechanism for this kind of, you know, sustainable development or collectivism or whatever you want to call it, for this idea that, you know, private property rights just aren't that important. I do a lot of work in the Clean Water Act area and the Endangered Species Act area, and those are two big tools, you know, chipping away. Chipping isn't even it, you know, thundering away at the foundation of private property rights in the United States. I mean, for one, you know, the Endangered Species Act has a big ability, has an unbelievable capacity to turn your private property into, you know, a national park, for lack of a better term. You know, anything that you do that harms a species, you know, could land you in jail. And that harm includes anything, you know, up to, you know, anything that impacts the feeding, the breeding, or the sheltering. I mean, if you scare a bird and it doesn't feel like, you know, having eggs that year because of it, you know, you could go to jail. It sounds silly, but it happens, you know. And you look at the Clean Water Act, which is not something that people are as aware of, and the wetland regulation of the Clean Water Act, this is another unbelievable area for abuse of private property rights. The first thing that comes to mind for me is actually a client of mine named John Rapanos. He's a landowner in Michigan, and, you know, probably a fairly well-off guy by now, but his family came to Michigan out of Chicago during the Great Depression. They were Greek and pretty low, you know, looked down upon as kind of low-class people at the time, and they built themselves up out of nothing, and he became a developer in that area. And he would buy property and, you know, improve it and then sell it to others for, you know, for use, good commercial use. So he buys a piece of property up near Midland, Michigan, which is kind of by Saginaw, if you're familiar with that area at all. And he goes out there, and it's none but trees. So he knocks down the trees, and there's some sand piles that have, it's naturally occurring sand on the property. He spreads it around the property to cover up the foundation of an old building. And the government comes out there and says, hey, you're filling wetlands. We want to come look. So he throws them off the property. They come back with search warrants and armed agents and execute a search warrant on this guy's property, arrest him, put him through 15 years of litigation with a criminal charge and of filling wetlands without a permit. You know, wetlands that, A, weren't even wetlands, and B, are on his own private property. So we got involved with Mr. Rapanos' case recently at the Supreme Court level. And looking back through the files, we took the case over from some other lawyers. Looking back through the files, the trial judge, you know, Rapanos was convicted. The trial judge, on the record, is saying, you know, this man didn't get a fair trial. They called this man the devil. They compared him, you know, to the, you know, atrocities that took place during World War II. They, you know, this man did not get a fair trial. And at the same day that the judge sentenced Mr. Rapanos, he had sentenced a drug dealer. You know, so here you had, you know, Mr. Rapanos, who is, you know, from this country and, you know, a citizen, a hardworking man, a taxpayer, you know, absolutely outstanding member of the community. His wife is on all kinds of boards and charities and things. You know, here's a guy who tried to use his property, and the government asked for 63 months in jail for him. And at the same time, you had this drug dealer who had come to this country, you know, to sell drugs and you know, poison our youth, and the government asked for 10 months in jail. So finally, the you know, the trial just said, I'm just not going to do it. Sentenced Mr. Rapanos to a fine and sent him on his merry way. Now, that wasn't good enough for the government, though. They appealed the sentence, and the Court of Appeal, you know, because it's stacked with so many judges who, you know, either have no understanding of private property rights or are hostile to private property rights, because anybody with a good understanding of private property rights isn't allowed in the Court of Appeal reversed and ordered the trial judge to send Mr. Rapanos to jail. We took his case over, appealed to the Supreme Court. They decided that they didn't want to hear it, and we've asked them to reconsider that decision, and that's where that case stands now. But this is a 60, I think he's 68 or 69 now, year-old grandpa, you know, who's going to jail because he's trying to use his private property. You know?
What strikes me there is not only is it outrageous on its face, and for the listeners, this story is actually told quite well by the New York Times in Monday's newspaper of this week?
I think it was Tuesday's paper.
Tuesday's? Well, we have that posted at the Audience Information Center. That would be at freedom21santacruz.net/radio. You can pull up that article from the New York Times that gives the facts in a way where any citizen would say, what is this? But the real problem here is that when I went to law school in that first semester, criminal law was about having a guilty conscience, a guilty mind, having caused harm to somebody's person or property. That's what it took to become even be accused of a crime. And here we have none of the indicia of that. What we have is a new system of justice based on what they call environmental justice, or using the precautionary principle. If you did something with your land that might have caused harm to some other species, then you must prove your innocence. And it seems to have turned our whole system of justice on its head. And I think this case is a perfect illustration of that, and it's why America needs to take stock of how our society is being changed right from under our view.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was out in Michigan when the New York Times reporter came there, and, you know, we fully expected her to be hostile, you know, being from the New York Times and being the environmental reporter. And when we took her out and showed her this property, and when we showed her, look, you know, this guy's not dumping sludge or oil on the ground, you know, he moved some sand around. She was really taken aback. You know, and you know, this guy is not a bad guy. He's just a, you know, John is just a regular guy who's trying to make his way in the world, and he's going to jail. And she was really taken aback. We were pleased with how the article outlaid the facts and to sort of showed people, look, this is really what's going on. I mean, we would have liked a much stronger piece, of course, but you know, she. We thought that we really turned her around from somebody who was ready to write a story about a bad guy who deserved to go to jail into, wow, wait a minute, look what's going on here. And, you know, to get back to the environmental harm and environmental justice theory, that reporter called, her name is Felicity Berenger, I think she called the former head of the Environment and Natural Resources Division of the Department of Justice, the people who brought this case or who sustained this case against Mr. Rapanos during the Clinton administration, and she called some environmental groups, and they kept we kept calling them Mr. Rapanos' wetlands because they're on his private property, he owns them, and the other side refused to call them Mr. Rapanos' wetlands. They called them the wetlands on Mr. Rapanos' property because they don't believe, and we finally pinned them down to this, they don't believe that those wetlands belong to John. They believe that those wetlands are held in trust for the rest of society, and that when he harmed those wetlands, he harmed society, and he deserved to go to jail. Now, irregardless of the fact there's not any wetlands on the property, but...
Well, that's quite distressing to me, and to our listeners out there, I would just suggest to think about this. if your action, whether it has to do in the environmental movement, is just a setup for more controls in more areas and realms of our life. And if a person, for doing what is the normal process of land ownership and land management, does something for which he has no evil intent, in fact causes no harm to any other person or their property, ends up in jail, well, this can happen in all fields of endeavor. It's a total breach with the historic notions of that are embodied in the Bill of Rights, and foretells a very disconcerting future. And again, that's why it's important that we not wait till it happens to us. It is happening to us, for one thing. I mean, our burden in this society, in order to support this ever-expanding government, separates us from our children, and separates us from the pursuits that we would take in an otherwise peaceful and happiness pursuing life. And that's why we all want to take concern and notice of the kinds of circumstances that cause some judges, appointed judges in our system, to do such outrageous things as to jail a man as this one.
Well, what's worse, you know, it would be bad enough if it were just Mr. Rapanos, who's a good guy, but you could sort of chalk it up to overzealous bureaucracy or something like that. But, you know, unfortunately, having dealt with Mr. Rapanos' case, which was pretty high profile, unfortunately, I have come to be involved with a lot of other cases in this area, and they're in Florida, and they're in Pennsylvania, and they're in Wisconsin, and they're in Massachusetts, and it always seems that there is one in every major region that you go to, and there's one guy who is held up, and there's one guy or one family who is punished severely as an absolute example to the rest of the property owners in the area. And I thought I was going nuts, you know, seeing this, and I thought maybe I'm reading into this and I'm too close to it. But you attend a conference with the Army Corps people and with the wetland people, and they will tell you that that's what they're doing, that they're finding property owners who are in, you know, minor violation, and maybe not even violation of the Clean Water Act, and they absolutely go after them with a relentlessness that is really unbelievable. I mean, I have a guy in Massachusetts that we're just about to take over his case, named Charlie Johnson. And Mr. Johnson is an older guy also. He's 73 or 74, I believe, and his family has been farming cranberries up in Carver, Massachusetts for 100 years. One day, the Army Corps and the EPA decided that he dug a ditch through one of the ponds on his property, and they decided that that was a wetland and that that violated the Clean Water Act, and they went after him. Now, they didn't go after him criminally. They didn't want to put him in jail. Instead, they went after him for civil penalties. So here we are, years later. Mr. Johnson has spent so much money on his legal defense that his family is basically bankrupt now. You know, a family that's been farming, his wife, his son, himself, that's been farming, you know, his parents that have been farming up in Carver for 100 years are now basically bankrupted. And the justice lawyer isn't a bad guy. He's a nice guy. I talk to him on the phone all the time. But this is absolutely their strategy, is to go after people and make an example of them.
Well, nice guys doesn't mean that they're moral guys. And I would suggest that any government lawyer who's participating in this kind of thing is someone who has abandoned their conscience and is doing what they ought not be doing. There is a duty not to steal. There is a duty to uphold the Constitution and not simply implement a program of sustainable development, because when you go to the federal government's web pages for Department of Interior or the EPA, it says we're here to implement the UN Sustainable Development Program in our country, which calls for the elimination of private property. That's what they're attempting to do, and that's what they ought to be foreclosed from doing by practice of their own moral standard. So they may be nice guys. What we found here in Santa Cruz is that all the good-looking, friendly guys who are working for the government are guys who are willing to say anything in order to advance this agenda. And the agenda is
is just not founded in any kind of moral principle, and I sure wish the client that you're representing that the courts come to their logic and make it right for this guy. You have to figure, if one guy stands up like that and bankrupts himself, how many other people fell in battle before they got to that point? And of course, the average citizen out there can't afford the attorney fees that's required to defend oneself, and so they simply get bowled over. So for every one John Rabanos, there are, I'll bet, 1,000 defeated citizens out there who have just been ruled off their property. And, you know, the people in the city need to recognize that as this program continues to whitewash over America, all of us will end up paying the price, because everything we have comes from the natural resources that are out in our rural lands. And when government takes full control of that, is their intent, and they're acknowledging that they say that openly in their meetings, and I've experienced the same thing, then there's something for the rest of us to stand up and give some thought to.
And it's unbelievable when you hear it. And I just want to slide in a quick word. You know, the endangered, we hear things like sustainable development and Endangered Species Act, and if you're not familiar with what those are really about, I mean, those don't sound like bad terms, you know. They sound, oh, sustainable development, that sounds like a good thing, you know. Oh, endangered species, we want to protect those. But, you know, my experience with the Endangered Species Act is, it is not about protecting the species. It's about controlling the use of land. And I had a great conversation with a Fish and Wildlife Service employee who only told me this on condition of that I wouldn't say his name. But I talked to him this morning, and, you know, he says that the environmentalists that sue them who claim to be protecting the species, they know full well that they are harming species, but their goal is to protect corrupts private property, so that's what they do.
Well, I characterize myself as an abundance ecologist. I work with land, and one thing I've learned is that resources respond very well to disturbance. If you want a diverse and productive natural landscape, you don't let it just get to its highest succession. You go in there and mix it around, and people put their hands on plants, but this new government apparatus has people putting their hands on people and telling the rest of us we can't manage our plants, and that's not good for people, and it's not good for the environment. And you're listening to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show, and we'll be right back.
After spearheading efforts to implement the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda in Santa Cruz, California, Congressman Sam Farr wrote,
"I am writing to congratulate you, the Advisory Board, and the Action Santa Cruz County Coalition for completing the Local Agenda 21 Action Plan."
Congressman Sam Farr then wrote,
"The Local Agenda 21 Action Plan not only has local significance, it also will have regional and national impacts. As you know, the President's Council on Sustainable Development is beginning Phase 3 of its work, with an emphasis on sustainable communities."
Sam Farr continued,
"I have been spearheading a similar effort to develop a process of sustainable development planning for the entire region."
So why does Sam Farr now say he's never heard of United Nations Agenda 21?
Yes, Congressman Farr, I'd like to my name's Daniel Beckett. I'd like your comments on the United Nations Agenda 21 program that you're implementing here. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But you endorsed it, sir. I have your paperwork.
United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda 21. If there's nothing to hide, why does Sam now deny it? This has been a public service question posed by Freedom 21 Santa Cruz at freedom21santacruz.net, inviting you to advance the cause of freedom in the 21st century. For more information about how you can advance the cause of freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw, and I'm here with our special guest, Greg Broderick of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And we've been discussing private property and why it matters to each of us and why it is the foundation for a free society. You see, liberty brings freedom, and freedom requires that we all develop a conscience. And we do that in our youth, and we do that under the nurturing guidance of our parents, not under the directives of a state authority. And once we've done that, we're able to express ourselves freely and to associate freely and engage in productive activities. And that leads us to the opportunity for free and voluntary trade. And all of that rests upon applying on a consistent and coherent basis the principles that are outlined in the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. And all of that leads to peace, and it leads to peace because we have personal and family autonomy in our society, and it's when it's predicated on the principles of liberty, and that requires private property as well, and which leads to prosperity and abundance, and that's why the kind of work that that young champions like Greg is so important, because while it may from time to time appear that liberty is losing to a rising collectivism in America, what's really happening is that the spirit of liberty is also rising in the background, and the battle over reason lies ahead of us, and if we can marshal our forces for spreading these ideas, you know, America holds a great prospect, not just for ourselves but for our posterity. And so with that, Greg, we've got a couple minutes left here on the show, and let's see what we might be able to give our audience that they can take away and gain a revised renewed and invigorated appreciation for private property.
Well, yeah, and that's what I hope they'd take away, and I hope they'd take away the idea that they need, you know, you need to pay attention to the issues, you need to understand what's going on. You know, it doesn't really take that much time to be informed. It doesn't take that much time to look around and see what's happening. It doesn't take that much time to stand up and say, I don't agree with this, you know. And you know, not everyone has to make a career out of it. You know, you can do your part by supporting groups that defend liberty. You can do your part by informing your friends about those groups, by referring people to those groups. You know, I mean, you talked about how a lot of people don't have the attorney fees, you know, or don't have the money to pay attorney fees for lawyers. You know, that's why groups like Pacific Legal Foundation are here. We work for free. Half our problem is, you know, generally people won't come to us for the case, or we won't hear about a case until it's very late in the process, and we work literally for free, you know, on donations that we get from people. But if we don't get the case in time, a lot of times there's nothing we can do. So, you know, if you have private property rights issues, if you are being abused under the Clean Water Act or the Endangered Species Act, you know, be aware and know of those groups out there that can help you. There are a lot of other groups like us: Institute for Justice, Washington Legal Foundation, New England Legal Foundation, Mountain States Legal Foundation. There are dozens of groups out there. You know, the Federalist Society has a great network of attorneys that work pro bono. So just be aware and be informed and be engaged. That's what I hope people take away from this.
Well, and as we close up the show, I'll say to the listeners,
check into the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website. You can get a lot of information there, and links to other organizations that are either involved in the grassroots movement or in the defense, like PLF, of the rights that we all hold dear and that we need if we're going to maintain a society that respects the supreme importance of each human being and that treats us as individuals and not as members of groups or a collective that are to be directed and controlled by centralized agency. And with that, I say good night and long live freedom. Greg, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Michael.
It's been wonderful.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to tonight's second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. This is the last day of August in the year 2005, and our topic for this hour is the nature of individual liberty and the Supreme Court's year 2005 debacle. So we're going to have talk about individual liberty and equal justice, and we'll ask some questions about where the legal system is taking the American society, and we'll ask even deeper of what is the nature of a legitimate government. Our guest for this hour is Mr. James Burling, who is the principal attorney for the Property Rights Division for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Last week, Mr. Burling issued a century report from the Pacific Legal Foundation, and in it he said, "The battle over property rights is not a conservative versus liberal thing. It's more a struggle between those who believe in the power of the state to dictate how we can get to use our homes and land versus those who believe that the state has no business destroying our right to make reasonable use of our property. That is because when the government can go about destroying with impunity our ability to use property, none of our liberties can be safe." And the author of that and our guest tonight, Mr. James Burling. Jim, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
Well, it's very pleasant to have you with us this evening. And in the last hour, our audience heard a replay of an earlier interview we did with another lawyer at Pacific Legal Foundation on private property. And that was recorded over a year ago, and certainly the events of the last year would verify that private property is moving up on the scope of Americans' awareness as it seems to be stripped away from us.
Absolutely correct.
Well, you take us through a little bit of what has happened in the year 2005 and what it means and what's at stake for each of us.
We've had three major cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court in just the last term, actually just this last spring. And in each one of those cases, the Supreme Court took an area of property rights and made those rights less secure for Americans. They had a case out of Hawaii where the court threw out basically 20 years of precedent that gave property owners a good argument in courts to argue that regulations are going too far because the regulations did not advance a legitimate governmental interest. In the second case out of San Francisco, they basically slammed the door shut to the federal courthouses, saying that people who want to vindicate their federally protected constitutional rights in property have to go to state courts and only state courts. In some states, that may be fine. But if you're in a state like California, maybe New Jersey, maybe Massachusetts, where the courts are very unfriendly to property rights, it's a real problem because now you can't go into federal court unlike any other civil rights. And the third case, and I expect we're going to get into a lot more detail about these all these cases this evening, but the third case is the one that everybody's heard about. They send the case out of New London, Connecticut, where a series of landowners led by Mrs. Kelo were told that they would have to leave their houses to make room for a private redevelopment project that involved stores, restaurants, and a shopping mall in support of a major pharmaceutical headquarters. And these people simply don't want to sell. They want to live. In one case, a woman has lived there since she was born there in 1918.
And we'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Radio after our stations take a break.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, and while some of our stations remain for the next 2 minutes away from us, we're going to continue our discussion with James Burling of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Well, Jim, that's quite a three strikes you're out for the citizen in the context of property law. I mean, it's a major, major hit, is it not?
Yeah, we're extremely concerned, and as a result of what's going on with the Supreme Court, it seems that they have lost their bearings. There were a few years where the court was issuing some pretty good decisions, but what's happened is that the moderates of the court and the liberals of the court, who don't necessarily believe in property rights the way that I think you and I do, they've essentially taken over the mindset of the court. And they're now issuing these rulings that make it very, very difficult for landowners who are faced with incredible obstacles to begin with. These landowners really have very little recourse in the courts at present. Now, I'm not saying that's not going to change because we got some strategies in the lower courts and the state courts that we're going to be using to try to restore these property rights. But we really need to have some real changes at the Supreme Court level, which with some of our justices, they just don't get it.
Well, but you talk about the liberals and the moderates, but two of these decisions were unanimous decisions.
Yeah, the unanimity of the decision, the Lingle decision especially, is very troubling. And I think what's going on there is that there's a retrenchment from the fear of being labeled activists. We had some very good property right cases in the 80s and early 90s and even up to 2001, the case that I argued there called Palazzolo.
And hold that thought for just a second. We're about to return our audience with us this evening. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with guest Jim Burling of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And for the stations that have just returned, Jim is describing how it is that the Supreme Court has lost its bearings in the context of the protection of our natural right to the use and enjoyment of our property. And we're discussing the the case of Lingle, the Hawaiian case, that was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court. It has a very dramatic effect on how property is viewed by the government.
Let me go into Lingle a little bit so your audience understands what was going on in that case and what happened before. There was a period of time starting in the late 1970s where the Supreme Court said that you can have two circumstances where you have a regulatory taking, that is, something that violates the Constitution. The first is when a regulation affecting property fails to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. And the second was when a regulation destroys the economic use or viability of property. And Lingle is all about the first one, failure to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. The state of Hawaii passed a rent control regulation affecting gasoline stations. You wouldn't think that gasoline stations are necessarily the favorite of legislators, but you see enough gasoline retailers convinced the Hawaii legislature to pass rent control that benefited them. And the major oil companies, Chevron in particular in this case, took this to court saying, look, if your purpose is to keep gasoline prices low, this isn't going to do this. This is only going to put money into the pockets of these people who rent gasoline stations from us. And they brought in a number of economists and experts. And the trial court concluded that this new law by Hawaii was ridiculous. It failed to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. And the Court of Appeal, the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit's not known as a particularly conservative court, it agreed. It said, no, this regulation fails to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. That got the state of Hawaii and a lot of opponents of property rights, that is, those people who love government regulation, the more the merrier, very concerned, and they got together and they asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take this case. And the U.S. Supreme Court took it, and as you said a few moments ago, there was a unanimous decision to basically throw out the standard that a regulation that fails to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest is a taking. The court said, look, that may be a violation of other parts of the Constitution, but the really favorable rulings that we've had in property rights no longer apply to that kind of regulation. And we even had folks like Justice Scalia join that, and Justice Scalia is normally very much on the side of property rights. And the reason why, and I think you may have been mentioned getting to this, the reason why people like Scalia voted, I think, the wrong way in this case is because he has been concerned by other courts that have essentially second-guessed legislative judgments. And Scalia doesn't think it's necessarily good that courts can second-guess legislative judgments. And he thought, well, that's essentially what's going on here. And we really shouldn't be doing that because in other times when we've had courts second-guess legislative judgments, they've created a right to abortion on demand. And Scalia is very, very much concerned about that. And I think what he and the conservatives failed to remember in this case is that it really is the duty of the courts to second-guess legislative judgments when liberty is at stake.
Well, of course. I mean, to suggest that a due process analysis is, when misused, suddenly becomes a necessary or poor tool is an enormous error of basic logic.
Right. It's no different than saying, look, if somebody uses a hammer to do surgery, that means we should no longer use the hammer for any purposes, including carpentry.
Well, exactly.
And that's the mistake that Scalia made here, and this is not the first time he's expressed misgivings about the use of this due process tool, but it's certainly the first time that he has really reversed, I think, several decades of very good precedent. And what this means is that we were using ourselves the tool of regulations that fail to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. We were using that to attack rent control in various places, especially California, and we had some success, again, in the Ninth Circuit. But what this decision means is that it's going to be more difficult to challenge rent control because we had studies with rent control, for example, that showed that in cities with rent control, you have all the things that rent control is supposed to do didn't happen. Rent control is supposed to help the poor, minorities, people with who are economically and socially dispossessed. But in fact, rent control favors those people who are richer, better educated, better, and more well off.
Sure, and it also protects the insider, economic player, and really gives way and massive support to this transition going in our economy from free enterprise to public-private partnerships. I mean, there are some communities. This one is a good example of where even the restauranteurs now are being managed and monitored by governmental authority. That they're green restauranting criteria, and certainly if you're a home builder, if you're not building to the standards of insiderdom, which is really sanctioned by this court case, it really says whatever local government says, even if they're making special deals with the inside players, that doesn't matter because they can pass these kinds of legislative enactments that that strip some, but not all, of the rights to use their property.
Yeah, and when you talk about building homes, one of the really pernicious things that we've seen in California and now growing in other states as well, the idea that if you build homes and sell them at a market rate, you also have to build subsidized housing. You have to sell homes at a subsidized rate to people of lower incomes. Now, that's a very noble cause, but what that means is people buying new homes have to subsidize, and people buying new homes, families starting out, are the people that can least afford this sort of subsidization, but they have to subsidize homes for poor people.
It's part of the reason we have such an extraordinary price levels throughout this state. When you put an urban growth ring so that you can't, you've limited the supply of land dramatically, like down to 1 or 2% of most states in the West these days, and then you put the subsidized housing requirements on top of it. You require your builder to be a sustainable developer or a nonprofit, and the costs go way up just because of
your costs go way up. You have to charge more for the homes, and people, young families moving in, can't afford them anymore.
And increasingly, we're getting a caste society of, which is exactly what happens when you start to intervene with economic liberties and with free enterprise. You end up creating these imbalances that those who are desirous of this outcome are planning for, because it begins to break the back. And then everybody's hurt. The people who got an increase in value through this in their own home find that someday the society has been, the principles of private property are so undermined that everybody becomes at risk for any of their own private property rights. And that has a cascading effect down to everything we do in life. So it's very key. I don't know if I've over read the Lingle case, but I look at it as saying it really does change the nature of our justice, because federal government is no longer charging itself with the duty to protect natural rights. Is that analysis a fair one?
I think the analysis is certainly heading in the right direction, because there are still some people in the federal government who recognize that our rights derive from something other than government. Our rights are inherent in us, and it is the duty of government to protect those rights. And you do see decisions on occasion that pay lip service to that, but the court is essentially making you fit your legal arguments through a smaller and smaller funnel. And yes, it says that the duty is to protect natural rights and so on and so forth, but you can't go into federal court to do that after the San Remo case. You have a much higher standard of proof after the Lingle case. You have to do a lot more than prove that the regulation fails to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest. And it's becoming increasingly difficult. So it's one of these sort of things where you're dying a death by a thousand pricks. Things are being ratcheted down bit by bit, and people can go along, and they're somewhat complacent to that because you don't see things happening overnight. I think the Kelo decision was the one that the court had not anticipated the outrage about that, which has gotten a lot of people energized when they see that you can have ordinary homes taken for other businesses. But these other two decisions, the Lingle one and the San Remo one, are these sort of things that just slide under the radar of most people, and I'm really glad you're talking about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about San Remo. I mean, there's a case that really does cause one to think they've traveled down with Alice into a wonderland. Tell us the facts of what happened to the
Chinese entrepreneurs. In San Francisco, a number of people owned hotels that they rented out to people on a longer term basis. And the San Remo Hotel rented out rooms on a long term basis according to a survey that they had to fill out in the 80s. It was one of these meaningless surveys they got in the mail, and they had some clerk check a bunch of boxes saying, yeah, we rent some rooms out in 30 days or more, which actually, as a fact, turned out not to be true, but that was too late. They were stuck with their survey.
Well, there's a little lesson there for people around the country. These surveys come around to businesses and to homes, and my family and my business just practices that we don't answer these surveys. They are never done so innocently as they pretend. When they go around.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
are real reasons for these surveys, and those reasons are not in the average citizen's best interest.
And so what San Remo learned a few years after the survey was turned in by a clerk was that they had their uses of their hotel frozen, which means about half the rooms had to be rented out to long-term residents permanently. And they said, this is ridiculous. We want to rent out to tourists. We're a tourist hotel. It's a nice hotel. And the city of San Francisco said, well, sure, if you want to rent out to tourists, that's fine. You just have to pay for the cost of replacement housing because your long-term tourist rates that we're sticking you with, which you actually didn't do, but we're going to stick you with that, those are for low-income people. So we need you, San Remo Hotel, to finance low-income housing in the city and build the equivalent number of rooms for people to live in. And they were charged $567,000 for the privilege of renting out their hotel rooms to tourists.
And, of course, this has the effect of taking the bootstrapping American entrepreneur and just shutting the door on him, while it allows the bigger players who are partners oftentimes with the government that passes these ordinances to do just fine.
This doesn't apply to Marriott. This applies to the small mom-and-pop individually owned hotel. We represented a hotel owner in the same issue called Claude Lambert in San Francisco. He was an immigrant from France. He came over here. As soon as he got over here, his welcoming committee was being held up with a knife and robbed of everything he had. He worked in a janitor of a hotel and eventually worked through hard work and savings, bought the hotel, and became the owner. And he was told he had to pay $200,000 for the privilege of renting his hotel rooms out. And the Supreme Court didn't take his case, but they did take the case of the San Remo folks that had to pay $567,000. And the owner of San Remo first tried to go into federal court, but he was told, no, no, no. If you're going to sue in a regulatory taking, you first have to go into California courts because of a case out of 1980 called Williamson County, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that taking cases first have to go into state court before you go to federal court. So San Remo went into state court, and he argued that this regulation requiring him to give up $567,000 was a regulatory taking. It failed to substantially advance a legitimate governmental interest, and it violated the law of unconstitutional conditions. He went to California court, and he lost all the way up to the California Supreme Court. And that was actually a decision where Justice Janice Rogers Brown issued a marvelous dissent. Unfortunately, it was only a dissent, where she said, in California, property rights are an endangered species, but in the city of San Francisco, they are extinct, which is why I think Janice Rogers Brown is such a wonderful judge. Anyway, they lost that case in state Supreme Court, at which point San Remo Hotel went back into federal court and said, I'm back. You told me to do the case in state court. I did it. I litigated my state constitutional grounds. Now I am back in federal court to argue that my federal constitutional rights have been violated. I didn't argue the federal constitution before. Now I am. And I want you, court, to declare this to be unconstitutional.
So if we just pause for a second, what we've got is this struggling entrepreneur who's been through a lot of litigation. He started out by going to the federal courts. They said, go to the state court first and then come back. He went to the state court, came back, still had a claim, a federal claim. He wanted the federal protection of his protected constitutional rights. And they said, no, you already had your chance. Is that
they said, hey, you litigated a similar analogous issue, the state constitution, in state court. That's pretty darn close to the federal constitution. These issues have already been decided. You can't argue this in federal court. And we thought that was ridiculous. He thought that was ridiculous. There is indeed, there was a decision out of the Second Circuit on the East Coast that had gone the opposite way. And it was a great conflict, and the U.S. Supreme Court took the case. And we were all pretty confident that we were going to get this ridiculous rule that you have to go into, you can't go into federal court after going into state court, thrown out.
And we're going to be back with some audience that broke away for a few minutes in just a second. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show discussing the San Remo case, which is a dynamic where the citizen went to federal court to protect their property rights, were told to go to the state courts. He lost at state court, went back to the federal court, and the federal court said, well, you already had your chance. Let's continue with that dynamic. Jim?
So they argued the case to the United States Supreme Court. I thought the attorneys did a marvelous job. It was not us, but some attorneys we know out of San Francisco. They did a marvelous job arguing the case, and they lost. They lost because the court said there is no right to bring a federal constitutional claim into federal court if the issue could have been litigated in state court. They said that, look, San Remo could have argued its federal constitutional claim in state court initially, and the fact that they had waited until they could go into federal court is just too bad, because our interpretation of federal law and the federal constitution is that if you have a chance to litigate an issue in state court, a federal issue in state court, you ought to do it, and you have no right to get into federal court on a federal constitutional property rights case.
So if we take and look at the Lingle Hawaiian case and the San Francisco case called San Remo, and overlay them, it sounds to me that the court says, oh, well, if the local legislature wants to do something, lest we not do anything to protect the people's rights. And if someone wants to bring their federal claim to the federal courts, you got to go to the state court, and we're going to again allow the state court to resolve it. Basically, the federal government, sounds to me, in two unanimous cases, has decided left, right, or center, so far as the Supreme Court is concerned, that the federal government does not exist for the purpose, or at least the courts do not exist for the purpose of protecting natural rights.
The one hope that we're left with after San Remo is there was a dissent, four justices, or a concurrence, I should say, where they said, well, we agree with the decision, but we think maybe the initial Williamson County rule that I mentioned from the 1980s needs to be looked at again.
You go straight to federal court without ever starting at state court.
Yeah, maybe you ought to be able to go state to federal court without having to pass through the state courts. We kind of agree that this doesn't look good, but the way this case proceeded, they did go to state court, and they should have brought their federal claims, and it's too late for them, but maybe somebody in the future can come back to us, and indeed we're doing that in a case out of Puerto Rico. We're going to ask them to look at it and throw out that Williamson County rule. I keep my fingers crossed that, you know, we'll see what happens, because that was only four members of the court, of which three are left, that said that.
Well, I think, let's hope the Supreme Court does something, because otherwise I think we've really got to begin to readdress strategy. But let's talk about the big case now, the one that people do know about, the Kelo case, because that begins to apply, I would sense, the rulings that you've already talked about tonight.
Yeah. The first two cases, we can talk about things that are a little more abstract. People don't really see that their property is going to be affected. Because, look, one was a hotel, and how many people own hotels? One was a gasoline company worried about rent control and gas stations, and, you know, who worries about that? But the Kelo case involved homes, just like the one that most people live in, or apartments like most people live in. And that was a case where the redevelopment agency in New London, Connecticut, really was anxious to change everything over. You have a lot of these redevelopment agencies, and they get this idea that they really want to be planners. They really want to play with the bricks and the sticks and build things and plan and do it, but they don't have money to do it themselves, so they use tax money, and they don't have land to do it themselves, so they take other people's land.
You're describing Santa Cruz.
Yeah, well, pretty much. And in New London, Connecticut, they decided that they needed to revitalize this downtown area that, you know, was blue-collar, quite frankly. It was middle-class. It wasn't ritzy. They didn't have a lot of, you know, latte shops and that kind of thing.
But this is where people live, real people.
Well, yeah, where real people live. You know, real people who have jobs and go to work in the morning and come home at night. And
well, raise their children, lead their own life.
Are here to
be alive and not here to be an agent of the state and moved around with the state once you moved around, a la Gaza Strip or something.
But they figured that, look, they can get a corporate headquarters in here for the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company, and then they can condemn a lot of property around that area to make things really attractive for Pfizer. So the Pfizer people will be happy to be there, and Pfizer, incidentally, happened to pay a lot more taxes than anybody else could have paid, being a big corporate headquarters. And the neighborhood surrounding that, it had to be changed over and turned into restaurants, shopping malls, and, you know, little office centers. And that was just marvelous. It was one of these plans that look really pretty on paper, and, you know, how can you not feel warm and fuzzy about it? You can have these little latte shops and people walking around in nice clothes and doing nice shopping. The problem is, you had an entire neighborhood of people who lived there. Mrs. Kilo lived there. You had a woman who was born in a house there who lived there since 1918. And these people were basically told, get out. Yeah, we'll pay you something for your property. We're not going to pay you a share of what this big corporation and this business is going to bring here, but we'll pay you something for the property. It might not be enough, but, you know, it's what we can get away with. And if you want to fight us over what we'll pay, you have to hire lawyers to do that. And the landowners were outraged, and they filed suit. They said, now, wait a minute. We read the Constitution, too. In the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution says that private property shall not be taken except for public use and without the payment of just compensation. And what is public use? And you go look at dozens of cases from the 1800s and up into the early 1900s, in the middle of the last century, and they said that public use means, well, public can use it. Things like roads, post offices, forts, military bases, in some cases, railroads, because public use the railroads themselves.
Or public parks.
Or public parks, certainly. But all these cases said you can't take property from one person, A, and give it to another person, B, because that would be the very definition of tyranny. That's what the Supreme Court said in the 1800s. And they repeated that language a number of times. So the Kilo plaintiffs in this New London, Connecticut case said, well, look, the Supreme Court has already ruled that you can't take property from us and give it to some private developer to build a shopping mall and little latte shops and a restaurant. That's just the definition of tyranny. And everyone in the redevelopment agency said, no. You just don't understand. You don't understand that things have changed. Because the Supreme Court in 1954, in a rather infamous case out of Washington, D.C., said, well, public use means public purpose. And public purpose means clearing away slums. And that was a redevelopment case where slums were cleared away and public housing was put up. But the Kilo people said, no, wait a minute. That was a case where businesses were taken down, but it was never a case where homeowners lost their homes to give their homes to businesses. And the government in the Kilo case said, no, you don't understand. Even if you want to distinguish that 1954 case, back in 1982, the Supreme Court said that you can take certain interests in land from big estates in Hawaii and give those to people who are leasing property from the big estates to have their homes on. But the Kilo people said, no, those were homeowners. That nobody was losing their home from that case. The Supreme Court, they said, has never taken away a private person's home before. And they took that case up to the Connecticut Supreme Court, lost, because, as I said, many state courts are not particularly sympathetic to property rights and federal constitutional liberties. and they took the case then to the U.S. Supreme Court. Once again, we had hopes that the Supreme Court would recognize that the 1954 case and the 1982 case out of Hawaii were very different, and that they should not use the what I would call the myth of public purpose as a substitute or a surrogate for public use to take people's private homes and give them to some corporation, some private redeveloper. And as you know, that the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said, homeowners, you lose. You lose your homes, and you have to move out. If this is a public purpose, because it's important to redevelop the area, there is a nice big plan with pretty pictures and maps, and it was all part of an integrated plan to do this. And it's, you know, your interests are secondary to the larger interests of the government and the state. Your private property rights are less important than those of making sure that the government in London has a convenient way of attracting business. And as you know, that case is utterly outrageous, and people across the country, unlike any other case that I can recall out of the Supreme Court affecting economic rights, people have become outraged by this decision.
Well, I'm a little concerned, though, that so many folks think that this was a 5-4 decision. They don't understand that the base, the cases that you described before, that the base for property right analysis has been so reduced that even the idea of the Kelo case as it was evaluated is the notion that government is going to choose. It's going to choose to grant what rights and what rights not to grant. And after Lingle, it seems to me that we really have an exaggerated case that illustrates just that, that rights now are granted. At least rights to property have to be granted by your local government or your state government, and that there is no government that is there that exists to protect your right. So once our right to property isn't being protected by government, well, the 19th century Supreme Court cases called that tyranny, as you referenced it, and that forebodes very poorly, and people ought to react as they are reacting to this Kelo case, but they need to understand, in my opinion, that the courts took a far worser move than a 5-4 decision in an outlandish case. They really set it up for all kinds of sustainable development activities like open space acquisitions and setbacks and set-offs without compensation. And certainly the whole move for the smart growth community with the inside developers building high-density stack-em and pack-em units along railroad tracks is something that's going to be spurred all over this country as a result of these kinds of decisions. What do you see, Jim, as the response to the Kelo case?
There are a couple of responses going on right now. In some states, there are efforts to have state legislatures pass statutes prohibiting this sort of eminent domain. Although that's had some success in a state like Alabama, I'm very concerned that it's really not going to work anywhere else. Just today, yesterday in California, there was a hearing at the state Senate about three alternative bills. One would have banned this forever, one would have put on a temporary moratorium, and one would have done nothing except make it easier to condemn private property. The redevelopment lobby has come out all guns firing, and they basically gutted and killed any chance in California for any meaningful reform. Maybe I shouldn't be that pessimistic. Senator McClintock is a little more optimistic that he still can pull something out. But to see the redevelopment lobby, because they have billions at stake in taking our property for their little pet projects, they are very well organized and make a lot of well-placed campaign contributions. And I'm not sure that the legislature is going to really get it in this state. In Ohio, they've tried passing something which is a watered-down bill that's going to study the problem, and we know what happens when you study a problem for a few years.
Well, we've talked about that old Fabian ideology called compromise and delay. You know, so
right.
We,
you know, you you have something in your wallet. Well, let's compromise about it. Give me half. You give me half, and then, well, let's compromise about the rest of it, right?
Well, that's why we say we just have to start saying no to a lot of these things.
And Nancy Reagan is right. Just say no.
Yes.
So the other thing that can go on is in some state courts, there was some fairly good progress before Kelo of putting a stop to this. Michigan had a wonderful case in 2004 where they threw out an old case that allowed this sort of redevelopment to occur, and they said, no, no, that's it. We're not letting this happen anymore. Illinois had a good decision where a racetrack was trying to take property through a redevelopment agency of a metal plating factory, and they were told they couldn't do it. They wanted to expand a parking lot for a racetrack. They said they couldn't do it. Even California, the lower courts here have been pretty good in stopping a Costco from taking a 99-cent store. But just across the border in Nevada, if you're a casino and you want to take property, tear down existing buildings and structures that belong to private individuals so you can put up a parking lot to serve casinos so they can have better strip shows, that's okay in Nevada. So on a state-by-state basis, I have some hope that we can convince state courts to do things better. But we have a lot of state courts, like Connecticut, who just don't get it. Our Supreme Court here in California is not friendly at all to property rights. One less friendly person there was the loss of Justice Brown, and I guess gain to the D.C. Circuit of Justice Brown. And the other thing we can think of is, with this outrage, is trying to get another case back to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you know, they've reversed decisions before that were very unpopular, and this may be another one to do it. Justice O'Connor wrote the dissent in the Kelo case. She wrote a very impassioned dissent. And
she also was the author of Lingle, though. So.
And she was the author of Lingle, and so she was a moderate. She got it right this time. You say even a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
Yes.
But she's not there anymore on this eminent domain issue. And Judge Roberts is another huge question mark in my mind, and a troubling question mark at that.
Well, we want to get to that before this show is over, but. We've got some callers on the line. Let's take a call from Tim. Tim, are you with us?
Hi. Hello, guys.
Hello, Tim.
Oh, yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to make a couple quick comments, and I had a question. You know, I'm so infuriated by this property rights issue. Obviously, it should be a state issue, but Big Brother, the federal government's got to stick its nose in there. And it's such an egregious act on our property, and why not one senator or one congressman has spoken out against this decrement here? And it makes me feel that the legislative branch and judiciary, the executive branch, you know, as opposed to keeping each other in check, they're in some type of cahoots or they're compromised. What can we do, you know, other than finding some tall trees and some short rope? And why won't these Congress people speak out against this? Thank you.
Do you have an answer or
to
that?
There have been, after Kelo came out, there were a number of folks on the Hill who did express outrage over the decision and said that we really need to do something to stop using federal money for some of this redevelopment. And so they have started to talk the talk. Are they actually going to walk the walk? I don't know. You naturally, when you had some of these concerns expressed by legislators who are Republicans, people like the brilliant political strategist Nancy Pelosi, I'm sorry, that was a dig, came out and said, no, no, that's just wrong. This, whatever the Supreme Court says is like God speaking, and we shouldn't second-guess the Supreme Court. But there was a move in California by the legislature. It was bipartisan to get this bill adopted. But as I said, that was put on the kibosh yesterday in the Senate committee. And whether or not you're going to have anything meaningful out of Congress, I don't know. I mean, one of the things you have to realize is that the redevelopment industry is very strong and very powerful, very well organized, and are able to place campaign contributions very effectively. landowners like you and me normally don't think of redevelopment until our homes are the target. And then we realize we don't have the kind of money our opponents do. So how do you get the right legislative influence? There are some very good people in Congress who have been talking about this, but whether that's going to be enough, I really don't know.
Well, my tendency here is to think that the federal government is not protecting our interests, that Congress largely is, they're implementing the Wildlands Project, and that's putting tremendous pressure on. The courts aren't protecting against the implementation of the Wildlands Project. The administration, every agency is dedicated clearly and plainly by their own writings to the implementation of sustainable development in the Wildlands Project. So the federal government, I think the caller makes this point, he may have been confused that he said the federal government's in our life. They are, but the federal government's supposed to do what they didn't do in Kelo. So we're getting the regulatory regime, we're getting the labyrinth of rules, and we're getting no protection on our rights. And so it is increasingly becoming my thought that within the next few years, because the Agenda 21 program moves so swiftly, it is going so fast through our schools and through our landscapes and through our city planning offices and the smart growth dynamics in our communities, that unless we elect substantially a new Congress, I mean, there may be some fellows who figure it out and get on the right side of this battle, but unless we divest the Republican-Democrat dynamic with regard to this Congress that is ignoring these issues and is not putting the Supreme Court in its proper role and have an executive that is not being held on a leash by Congress, we're going to continue to fall, and we're going to continue to fall even at a faster rate. We also have a call from Roger in Pennsylvania. Roger, what question might you have for Mr. Berman?
Yes, thank you, gentlemen. I'm asking, if possible, if you could give a bulletproof answer to which the last caller had a bit of subtext in there on, and I think it's an ugly question, or at least the answer might be appropriately ugly for us advocates of state rights, that is, stripping the FedGov its now nine-tenths usurped powers. And while virtually every establishment conservative cast this as the federal supreme throwing it back to the states, I take it from reading that they did no such thing per se. That is, they did not deny themselves the power. That would be appropriate first off, and then the follow-on really gets to the core of the question, if you please.
Roger?
Your guest, they really didn't deny themselves the power as such, but my follow-on would be, I suspect they probably should not have, according to Article 5.
Jim, do you...
Well, I think what you're asking, Roger, is this a question of state rights, and perhaps the federal judiciary should not be interfering with state issues. And I think the answer to that is that, you know, the purpose that government was put forward, if you look at the Declaration of Independence, and if I get a little philosophical about this, the government was formed in order to protect our liberties. The Declaration of Independence tracks very closely the philosophy of John Locke, who said, you know, government exists not to give people rights, but to protect the rights of people that already have those rights. And the state courts should be the primary entity protecting individual rights. But after the Civil War, we realized that the state courts, the state governments, were not necessarily always going to fully protect the rights of individuals like they should. And the 14th Amendment was adopted, which gave the federal government, the courts in particular, the power to protect individual rights. Not to take power, but to limit power of state and local governments in order to protect individual rights. And so I don't have any problems of saying that one of the duties of courts is to protect individual liberties, when that means that it's really limiting the power of both the federal and state governments.
I think that's right. Certainly the courts have made a mess of that application of the 14th Amendment. But those of us who went to school in this pre-New Civics era all did understand that the purpose of government was to protect our rights. That's how you have a free country, after all, and that was basically understood. But I recall, Jim, when I was in law school, second year law school teacher in constitutional law, the year of Roe v. Wade, And it, the 14th Amendment had to do with making sure that everything was equal between people. And it had nothing really to do with the application of principles of equal justice applied by the states, protected by the federal government.
Well, we've had some very clever law professors and judges over the years that have been able to take language that says black and says it really means white. And the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence talks about creating an equality of opportunity, not an equality of result. And that's a really fundamental difference. And the 14th Amendment was designed to make sure that people were treated by the law equally, not that people would be guaranteed equal results. And equality and liberty are those sort of things that are should be fundamental to a government. But if you're going to try to guarantee equality of result, you can only do so by broadening and increasing the power of government, because that is not a natural thing. If anyone hasn't read it, the book Friedrich Hayek, Road to Serfdom, really talks about that in a great amount of detail, that if government is going to get into the business of guaranteeing equality of result, guaranteeing that people have the same incomes and equal access to housing or whatever, if the government gets into that business, the government has to do it by force. Michael, are you there?
Mike from Minnesota, are you with us?
Thank you for having me.
Yes, Mike. What's your question to Mr. Burling?
Can you hear me okay? I'm getting some interference on my end.
Well, we can hear you fine on this side.
Okay, great. I just wanted to make a comment, and then I have a question to ask, and then maybe another comment quick. About private property, you used to be able to buy land in an allodial title, and that was the truest form of title. Now they've kind of gotten away from that with all these different kinds of ways of titling property, and the other titles basically give the land government as collateral. They can use it as collateral. I was wondering, how does this eminent domain affect allodial titles, if you know? And now my last comment was, people have to understand the difference between rights and liberties. Liberties are privileges that can be taken away. Rights are rights. They can't be taken away. So when you're talking about rights and liberties, you really have to distinguish between the two, what you're getting at. Don't confuse the one with another.
Well, certainly the point of whether rights are unalienable or whether rights are granted is key to this whole subject, and it's key to the whole dynamic between the difference between the Declaration of Independence and the Declaration of Human Rights. One is recognizes our inherent rights to certain things is based on the natural law, and the other is based on the idea of legal positivism, which means whatever the ruler edicts is what the law is, never mind natural rights. And of course, that's really the essence of our subject tonight, is how is the Supreme Court addressing the issue of rights. And, to the extent that they're granting, they could have decided in Kelo that they're going to grant the rights to those homeowners, but the issue really ought not be about what the Supreme Court grants. It's about what the Supreme Court protects. What would you say about that, Jim?
No, you're absolutely right. That rights, as I've said and you said, are something that are natural, given to us by God. If you don't believe in God, at least you can say that these rights are not given to us by government. This is the whole basis of the Founding Fathers, and they looked at rights, and when they were concerned about what the king was doing, the king was treating our rights as something that the king could give or take away at whim. And the Founding Fathers said, no, our rights are something that we inherently have, and we don't thank the government for our rights. We thank natural law for our rights. It's our part of our fundamental liberty, and government is not in the role of doling out rights. The Supreme Court, in a case called Palazzolo, had this nice language that said you can't put a Hobbesian stick into the Lockean bundle. And what that means is the debate between Hobbes and Locke back in the 18th, 17th century, where Hobbes said that rights are those that when we form government, we give all the rights to the government, and the government lets us have whatever rights are necessary and convenient for the government to operate. And Locke said, no, no. These are our rights. We own them. We don't give them to government. Government is there to protect rights. And that's the fundamental basis of our Constitution, the sort of thing that a lot of the progressives and legal positivists, as you call them, have forgotten over the years. Now, just a quick aside to the question about allodial title. Eminent domain applies to any kind of property that somebody can own, and it really doesn't matter what the basis of the title is.
Okay. You made mention earlier of the Supreme Court nominee, John Roberts, and I've seen some of the writings you've done on John Roberts. The information you have might come as a surprise to many people across the country, but what is the track record for John Roberts on the fundamental issue of freedom, that is, one's use and enjoyment of their own private property?
Well, his track record is not very good at all, and I find it very disturbing, and I know a lot of conservatives are getting behind John Roberts because he looks like the latest greatest hope, but based on two things in particular, he gives me a great deal of concern. The first one is the fact that in 2002, he argued a case dealing with landowners in Lake Tahoe, where there were, starting out in a case, were over 400 landowners, which over time of 20 years of litigation were whittled down to a few dozen, mostly elderly and certainly mostly middle-class landowners who owned a lot or so up in Lake Tahoe. And they've been trying to develop it for all this time, and they were beset by this massive regional bi-state compact agency which imposed moratorium following moratorium and then finally regulations that said this property couldn't be developed unless you could jump through a number of hoops that would cost far too much in money and time than these people could possibly ever justify. And the landowners had argued that their property had been taken. Look, we couldn't use it at all during the period of the moratorium, therefore it had been taken. And the Tahoe agency, responsible for these regulations, went out and hired John Roberts at a substantially reduced price in order for him to argue the case against the landowners. And John Roberts, Supreme Court nominee, went and argued before the Supreme Court that just because these landowners had lost all use and value of their property during the period of the moratoria, they were not entitled to any compensation, because really what the court has to do is balance the importance of the regulation against their losses, and besides, their losses are only, you know, temporary, because someday maybe this property can be developed if the regulations are ever erased.
And how long did this moratorium sit on the heads of these owners before?
Well, first one was 3 years, and then there was another 3-year moratorium, and then another 15 or 20 years of regulations that prohibited the use of the property.
So these people bought this property and had been waiting and trying to use it for several decades.
For decades.
For decades.
Okay.
But in the course of geological time, it, of course, isn't very long, and so it isn't a taking. Is that kind of the argument that Roberts made?
Maybe in the year 2100, one of them can be allowed to develop their property. So it hasn't lost all value, and therefore, they are not entitled to compensation because it's not a taking, and you just have to look at, therefore, the importance of the regulation, and boy, it's really important to keep people from using their property. Well, at Lake Tahoe. And Roberts argued that at a substantially reduced rate. Now, maybe he did that because he was friends with another lawyer who was going to argue it and couldn't. But he wrote a law review article in 1978 where he essentially made the same kind of arguments that he made in the Lake Tahoe case. So this isn't something new to him, and it's not something he just did to win a case for a client, I think. I think he said it because he believes it. The 1978 Law Review article in Harvard Law Review talks about the fact that a regulatory taking should be found only after we go through all this balancing. And even if you do find a taking, the remedy really shouldn't be to pay people money. It should be to pay them perhaps
something like a transferable development credit, something other than their property.
Some gimmick. Well, I want to thank you very much. That was a fast hour. Our time is over, and thank you very much for the tremendous work you've done. We're up against the wall. You guys are thinking, and that's marvelous. And I look forward to talking with you and the people at Pacific Legal Foundation again soon. And in the meantime, let's just remember that ordinary people rule America. We just need to take back the government, our representative democracy. And check our website, freedom21santacruz.net. Welcome back next week to our show at Radio Liberty Network. Good night.
Good night, Michael.